Welcome to Living with Dying, a podcast where we're going to talk about the unspeakable, everything to do with death and dying, and how to live with it. We're all on the same journey towards the end, but we just never talk about it. We don't like to think of our own life ending, and we certainly don't like to contemplate losing our nearest and dearest. So we all join in this huge conspiracy, pretending it won't happen to us. And then, when it does, we're often ill-prepared. So we're saying, let's talk about death. Let's open up the subject, and by listening to other people's stories, glean some advice and tips on how best to approach death, how to deal with loss, and how to rebuild a life after. So Sandra Jeffs, you're in the position which I think almost everybody dreads of being a mother who lost a child, and most of us can't contemplate what that's like. Would you like to start by telling me a bit about your son, Michael?
Yes, I would. Michael died in 2022. He was 27 years old when he died. He died from a soft tissue sarcoma. This goes right back to when he was born. At 3 months old, he was diagnosed with bilateral retinoblastoma, which is a cancer in the eye. We never knew this existed, so it came as a complete shock and body blow, as you can imagine, to be told that not only did he have eye cancer, but he would have to have his eye removed. And the other eye also had a tumour, which they thought they could save. So after surgery, he lost his eye. He had a month of radiotherapy. He was so small, he had to have a general anaesthetic every day for his radiation.
Gosh.
And it was as a result of that radiation that in 2017, the recurrent tumour came back, the sarcoma. And that is a side effect of radiation, but 25 years down the line, you kind of forget and don't look out for it or think about it. So growing up, although Michael had an artificial eye, hardly anybody noticed. It was amazing. He lived the perfect happy childhood on a farm with his sister, who's 18 months older. And I would say they pretty much had a perfect happy childhood. Despite the regular trips up to London we had to do for checkups, he was kind of oblivious. He didn't have the worry that we held for him. And he did well at school, went on to university in Birmingham, and graduated and went to work for Apple in London. And it was sort of the early days for him. He'd done his year in industry at Apple, and they'd taken him back. And it was his dream job. He absolutely loved it. He traveled to California regularly for them. And his life was literally taking off. He bought his first house. And then this body blow came when they picked up on a routine scan the tumour, which was just at the back of his nose. So he went and had surgery for that. And then it progressed, really. We thought we were over it again. They were happy with the surgery, thought they'd removed the tumour successfully, but then a couple of years later it had come back at the base of his skull, base of his brain, basal skull, and everything went downhill from there.
That sounds like a horrendous roller coaster.
Yeah, it has been. It's almost a blur now, to be honest, Elise. It's almost too horrendous to recount. But Michael, in his incredible wisdom and thoughtfulness, in the last year of his life, he wrote a website, his own website, rather than a book. He decided to put it all on a website. And he wrote the story of his life. And that was an absolute gift for us, because he described his life as having lived his life the best way he possibly could, and better than most people would in an entire lifetime. He felt he had achieved and done everything he wanted to do. And most of his friends growing up at university and even at work didn't realise Michael had an artificial eye. He never talked about his illness. It never defined him. So when he became terminally ill, he wrote the story, and then when he subsequently died, people were amazed at what he'd actually endured and gone through and carried on working through right up until the end, really.
And that must be a fabulous resource for you to have.
It's amazing. It was an absolute gift. You know, it explains everything in his words, not in our words. It explains how he felt, not how we felt. And it gives us great comfort. And I know it's been a huge inspiration to so many people to realise what you do have and how you should live your life. Knowing what Michael knew, if you don't, just because you don't know that, you should still live your life as best you can, because none of us know what we've got.
Did he describe how he felt about dying? Was he that open?
Not too specifically, no. I think he had about 18 months from the terminal diagnosis to dying, and we would talk about it ourselves, but he didn't write that in his website. The only sort of nod he put to it at the end was, please don't ever say I lost the fight against cancer, because he said to me, you know, if you die, it doesn't mean you've lost the fight. No one wants to lose that. And it's not a battle to win or lose. It's the cards. And he said, and the way to look at it for him was, you know, if you die, the cancer dies too, and that's a draw. And I thought that's
a really original way of looking at it, isn't it?
Yeah. Because it's not a choice whether you win or lose. Mm-hmm. And I think that was his outlook.
That's such a fresh approach, because you see all the time in newspapers and things, don't you, people talking about having battled with cancer. And if you undergo cancer, you don't necessarily think of it as a battle, do you? People react differently, though.
I think so. And it's not, I don't think there is a choice. It doesn't mean that people, that there isn't anyone that fights harder. No one wants to die. It's not a choice. It's not a win or lose. And I'm so glad he had that outlook. And I think he drew strength from that outlook, that it wasn't from lack of trying or lack of, you know, going through all the horrendous therapies and treatments that they fire at you to try and get rid of this disease. It was, you know, they'd done everything they could, and this was, the way it was.
You said earlier that you talked about his dying, his upcoming death. Are you happy to tell me a bit more about those conversations?
Yes, of course. When he was given the terminal diagnosis, I was in hospital with him in London. It might sound strange to a lot of listeners that I think from that very young age, when he was 3 months old, the bond was sealed with us, that we were so close as a mother and son. And all through his treatments in the last 5 years, he'd let me stay in hospital with him. He came back to live with us. We were really close and comfortable. And so he was in hospital when he had that diagnosis. It was in the midst of COVID, and I had begged for them to let me in with him. And luckily I was. So they came and delivered that diagnosis. And the first thing he said to me, Mum, was, Mum, you've got to promise me you'll be okay. Oh. And that was all he cared about. Yeah. From there, it sort of opened up the conversations, you know. He wasn't just saying that. It was so important to him. And I guess we were lucky we had the time to talk about things that mattered to him. I was fortunate I had the time to write. I wrote him a letter. I didn't want it to be the eulogy at his funeral that he didn't ever hear. So he was in no doubt about how I felt about him and how, you know, my husband and daughter felt. And it was reciprocal, because he made time. He wanted to tell us all what was important for my daughter, what he wanted for her going forward. And we would all have individual discussions. And in the later, sort of last week of his life, he'd call us all into his room individually. And he was very adamant that he wanted to tell us specific things. You know, with my daughter, she was in her third year of her counselling studies, and he was very adamant that she carried on and continued, and that she set up her business. And there were things he needed to say to us, and he gave us all the opportunity to say what we needed to say to him. And then, excuse me, he was such an organised, thoughtful person. He'd written everything down. You know, there were files and files. He'd written down what was important for his funeral, who he wanted to ask, the contact list of who to contact. He'd done it, he did it all for us, which was quite amazing, really. He told us that he didn't want a religious ceremony, didn't particularly believe in God, but he wanted Jerusalem played at the service because he was a big rugby fan. So we did that, and it felt nice knowing that we were sort of carrying out his wishes and doing what was important to him.
He sounds like a remarkable person.
He was, and I know I'm incredibly biased, but he truly was. And one of his friends actually wrote a description of him, and they said, Michael is a masterpiece of kindness, courage and love. And I thought, in fact, we put that on the order of service because that was it. I think the hospice staff here throughout Michael's stays and when they would come and visit him at home, they would always say, hello, Michael, how are you? And he'd say, good, thanks, how are you? And he never wanted sympathy, or he was very gracious in his outlook and always cared for other people. It wasn't just they'd come to see him. He wanted to know that they were okay as well. And I think, yeah, he was an amazing young man.
And were you all together, the whole family, when he died?
We were, yeah. He was at home. He was on a syringe driver for pain. I think they said they'd never had to give so much pain relief to a patient outside the hospice. And yes, we were sort of doing sittings when we'd be with him all through the night and take it in turns to sleep for an hour. My daughter had been with him through the night and woken up, and she said, I think we need the hospice round. He doesn't seem quite right. They came, gave him some more pain relief and left. And 10 minutes later, we just noticed his breathing had changed. He wasn't quite right. They came back straight away, and the three of my husband, my daughter and myself were with him, and he was squeezing, almost pumping our hands really, really hard, and then just suddenly let go. And yeah, it's the first time I've ever seen somebody die. And I think seeing somebody with cancer die, especially the type Michael had, is traumatic. Sadly, it's not just going to sleep. It's pretty awful, but instantly there was peace in his face. It was almost like looking at him as a baby. All that pain had gone. Yeah, and I think it doesn't matter how long, you know it's coming. It's hard, as you know too well. Yeah.
Yeah, even when you're expecting it, it's so very final.
It really is, yeah. And you just want that one extra minute. And I can honestly say I don't have a single regret, or there was nothing left unsaid between us. And that's a very lucky and fortunate position to be in, I think. And I think that's something I wish for everybody, that don't ever leave something unsaid. Just say how you feel, tell people, because you don't ever want to get to that point and have a regret that you've missed your chance.
And most of us don't know what's around the corner,
no.
Do we? You had that gift in a way,
didn't you,
at the time, to say everything you wanted to say. But yeah. If we don't say it when we don't know what's coming around the corner, things can get left unsaid.
Yeah.
Do you take any comfort from the fact that you had all that time with him towards the end?
I do, and I think I feel so fortunate that he was willing for us to be part of that. You know, the last year he moved home with us, and it was, you know, he was my night and day. I was literally with him, whether we were back in the hospice here or whether we were at home, and never left his side. And it felt we had a lot to cram in that time, a lot to say. We did as much as we could. We did some family trips together. But I do feel fortunate that we had that time. We knew, I can't quite imagine what it's like to lose someone in a tragic accident where you, it's so out of the blue. I wouldn't make a comparison between the two, but we were fortunate to have that time with him. It will never be long enough, though.
But at the same time, I would imagine that long time you had that last year would have taken its toll on you, wouldn't it? Did you not get exhausted?
Yeah, completely. I think my grieving started for him when he was a baby. You know, that was a period of my life that I grieved, missing having a baby that was healthy and well and enjoying that. And then I think you do a pre-grieving. You know that somebody's very ill, and then when it becomes terminal, I think you're pre-grieving that what's going to come, and it's incredibly exhausting, and I think it takes a huge toll on the family because each individual deals with it very differently. For me personally, I was the hands-on at the front, on the front line with Michael, going to hospital, going to all the appointments, looking after him at home. My husband's grief, he managed that by carrying on work and trying to keep the normality going in our life. And at times I found it was a bit of a rub between us because I thought, how can you carry on when all this is going on at home? But now I can see much more clearly that A, that was his coping strategy, and B, he was the normal that we all needed in our life, the sort of constant. When everything else was thrown up in the air, he was keeping everything going. So yes, it did take a toll. And I took counselling from the hospice in that year prior to Michael dying. And that helped me enormously, I think, because it was an avenue to get all that upset out. And then I could go home and deep breath and here we go again.
But once he died, obviously you had the shock of the death to deal with, but you also had a great void in your life because you'd been so busy looking after him for so long. And presumably you...
And that's still there, I think, Dilith. I think I've just, as I said to you, Michael was my day and night. He was my purpose in life, really. And that purpose is gone. You know, I'm still a mum to my daughter, Emily, but she's independent. And that whilst she does need me, she's grieves, you know, in her own way, and I'm trying to protect and look after her. It's not the same. I don't work. So I've just started counselling now with different psychologists to kind of figure out what my purpose is in life and recognise that 18 months on there is more grief and more trauma to work through, and hope that somehow going through that I can find where I'm heading. And I know that's what he'd want, and that's what spurs me on.
So I remember that you told us near the start that he asked you to promise to be okay. Gosh, that's a tough ask, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you think about that every day?
I do, yeah. And I will honour that with my last breath.
But how do you honour it?
By getting up every day. I think there's so many days that I think I just can't face the day. But I can hear his voice saying to me, come on, Mum, come on. And it seems like I would be doing him such a disservice to give up, because if he had the chance, he would never have given up. So I do it for myself, I do it for him, I do it for my husband, I do it for my daughter, because he would want nothing less from any of us than to live a full and happy life. But somehow I battle with that. I feel like, how can I be happy without him? Because being happy almost, you feel, am I forgetting all the sadness? And somehow I feel like you have to hold on to that sadness. I think this is probably an area that I've still got to deal with. And I think they call it survivor's guilt, don't they, sometimes? I don't think it's a guilt, but I just wish it was the other way around, that he was here doing that, not me.
So you're saying that you can feel guilty if there are moments of happiness. Do you think perhaps you shouldn't be feeling those because you should be sad more of the time?
I don't think I should be sad more of the time. I think I should be happier more of the time. That's the ideal, because we can't change what's happened. We have to deal with it. But I think it's hard to sort of find the happiness that's proper happiness. I think when I'm with people, it's quite a big show, that I'm okay, everything's fine. You go out for dinner and I think everyone looks at you and thinks, oh, you're doing so well. But it's a very hard, it's like we're wearing a cloak that people don't see underneath and see what's really going on. They don't want to see that. Nobody wants to see somebody with such desperate sadness. So, you know, I can go about day to day, see people, meet up with my parents and be fine. But there, I also recognise there's times I need to be at home and need to just be in that grief on my own. And I feel safer on my own in that grief.
Rather than sharing it?
Yeah. Because I don't like the thought of upsetting people or people being worried about me or upset about me.
It's a sort of reflex, isn't it? I think we all have that we try to protect other people. But I, through the course of talking to people and doing these chats, I wonder if it's best for us, really, because it is a pretense, isn't it? We go around with that cheerful smile on, we say, I'm okay.
I think there's an element of fear that people are going to say the wrong thing. You know, they're going to say, I understand, or they'll say, oh, my dad died, or... And those things I just still find very jarring, because I think, just like, I couldn't possibly understand your grief. I don't think anyone, it's a lonely path grief, isn't it? It's your grief and your grief alone. And whilst my husband and daughter, we all lost the same person, our grief for Michael is different just because we're different people. And I think I'm fully aware people want to be kind and want to be helpful, but nobody knows the right thing to say. I don't actually know if there is the right thing to say. And there are very few people, I think, that can sit comfortably with somebody's grief and not feel they have to say something to make it better. The reality is nothing will make this better for me. I know I will carry on and lead a happy life without a shadow of a doubt, but no one can erase this grief or feeling.
And it's such a big thing when it's a child and you've given birth to that child. It's so different from other kinds of grief, isn't it?
It really
is. It must
is.
Be. I mean, I don't know, but I'm imagining.
Yeah. I think two friends who also lost a son, one I connected with on a cancer website, her son was going through cancer at the same time as Michael, and we connected and we sort of went through the journey together, and he died 3 months after Michael. And she lives up in Scotland, and we're almost like pen friends over, you know, on the internet now. And I find she's probably the one and only person that I feel you really understand what this feels like, because you know, you've lost a son too. I think that's the only person that I feel really truly understands what this feels like.
So are you completely open with her?
Yeah.
You share everything?
Yeah. Yes, and I think I haven't met her yet, but my plan is maybe next month I'm going to go and see her.
It's a really interesting point you make, because quite often I have asked people what kind of support would they have liked from friends that they didn't get, but you're kind of suggesting there isn't anybody out there who could put themselves in your shoes, and you don't really want them to, and you're protecting yourself by not letting them in.
Yeah, yes, I would say that, although I think I was thinking coming here actually, if there are groups within the hospice of sort of bereaved parents, maybe, I think people that with a similar loss can relate better to each other than your friends, you know, more and more friends of mine are losing their parents now at that age. To me, you know, that isn't a comparative grief, and there probably isn't any comparison to be made, but I can't relate to that in the same way, because I know, you know, my parents are 86, and I accept that, you know, they will die in the foreseeable future. But I know from the grief that I've experienced, it will be a very different grief. So it's just hard. It's just hard to relate to people.
I guess that's all to do with hopes and dreams, isn't it? Because you as you said, everybody expects their parents to die. Nobody expects their children to die before them.
No. But I remember seeing one counsellor quite a few years ago, and she actually said to me, she said, oh, just think, Sandra, he's never going to actually have to lose his mum. And I thought, he would have dealt with that. He would have dealt with that as most people have to deal with it, that doesn't make it the other way around is okay. It will never be okay. Yeah. But I think, I don't want to sound that there's, like, it's helpless or no one can help, but I think it's a very deep understanding of, you know, it's even different to losing a young child. I think there's almost a gap, and I've noticed because I've searched out support groups, there's almost a gap of grieving support for parents that have lost a young adult, because it's unusual. Mm. Yeah.
So can you tell me a bit more then about how you have coped, how you have got on, how you have got up every day?
Yeah. So I, not long after Michael died, I decided to come back to the counselling here at the hospice. And I don't think I would be sitting here today without that. I think it was because the counsellor I had here had gone through the pre-grieving process with me. She'd known Michael, met him. It just felt like a continuous journey of somebody that really understood how this had felt, what we'd been through, how traumatic it was. So those weekly sessions I had here were amazing, and I did feel like I'd got everything out and was able to go home and almost help the others, because my husband wouldn't take counselling and my daughter also wouldn't take it. So I did that. I have got a very supportive family and friends around, and we decided not long after Michael died that we needed to move house. It was something we'd talked to about him. So we kind of threw ourselves and our energy into thinking, right, come on, we need to move from here. It's all very bad memories. I can remember the counsellor saying to me, are you sure it's not too soon? You're not rushing into this. But we've always moved, so it was nothing new for us. So we threw ourselves into that project. And within 6 months of Michael dying, we had moved house. And it was a complete renovation project. So throughout last year, January to probably September, I've thrown myself into doing that. And I think that's been a huge coping strategy for me. And it's only now that the project's finished that I've come back to thinking, I need something to give me purpose and to keep going. So recognising that, as I said to you, I've gone back, found a new counsellor that can help me not necessarily look back at all the trauma, but look forward to how I can sort of pave out a new path in my life. And part of that is constantly thinking, what can I do to honour Michael's name? What can we do to make a difference to people? Because he would have helped anybody. And I think going forward, I'm kind of waiting for a light bulb moment to come on, but I think there will be something and some way that we will honour his life and hopefully help other people.
Going back to moving house, that was a big letting go, wasn't it? Was that not difficult to leave those memories behind and things that had belonged to him in his room and those sort of things?
It was and it wasn't. We'd moved there when he was re-diagnosed and he'd had his first surgery. We moved, so we were only in that house for 4 years. And it wasn't Michael's family home. He had his own flat. So, he had the terminal diagnosis and he moved back home. And from that point, the house felt like a very sad house. Yes, not happy memories. And I can understand, and I did think, but Michael was in that room. That was, you know, where he died. But I instantly, when he died, I thought, he's not here anymore. We opened the windows and I just knew he wasn't in that house. He wasn't part of that house. So it wasn't hard. I think it felt harder, people assuming it was hard, and questioning myself, thinking, oh gosh, am I mad? Am I doing the wrong thing? Because everyone else thinks it's wrong. But it really did turn out to be the best thing we did. Yeah, and we obviously took everything that belonged to Michael. We still have that. So it's not like everything's been thrown out and different. But I think for me, a home isn't a place, it's in my heart. And yeah,
what you say makes perfect sense, because you were leaving bad memories behind, in fact, weren't you?
Yeah,
it wasn't somewhere where you had loads of lovely memories of him.
Yes, and he, you know, Michael and I would sit there on the internet sometimes looking at houses, and he said, oh, I think this would be great for you, Mum, out in the country. And so it felt like we were following a path that he was happy. He would have known that we were doing that. And we took his ashes with us. And knowing how frequently we tend to move, we decided he wanted us to plant a tree with his ashes. So we went and bought a lovely tree and a big copper pot so we could transport it wherever we moved. And so his ashes there in the garden with us. So he's there with us. Yeah, he's just in our hearts always. Yeah, I think a promise is a promise. I think it's not just because I said I'd do it. It means the world to me to do that. And I think when I die, I think my biggest fear would be, will everyone else be all right? That was his biggest fear. And I just there's no point in living and not being all right. We've got to do our best, haven't we, to carry on and almost honour his life, really, and do the things that he couldn't do. I think one of the things that's important to me is to keep moving forward. It doesn't matter how small the steps are, but if you keep making small steps forward, that's the best I can do.
So. And I think you will get that light bulb moment. It feels like you're working your way towards it, doesn't
it? Yes.
And he would appreciate that, wouldn't he?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I think he'd just say in one of his many writing down instructions, please don't ever stop talking about me. And I think he has so much to offer still by his story he told. The Stand Up to Cancer people, I got in touch and asked if we'd like to share his story. I don't think I can do that. I don't think I could do that. I'm not brave enough. But I think from Michael's story, people can learn that there is, in extreme circumstances and sadness, there's still good to be found, and still you can still live your life as full as you possibly can. And he really did do that. So
you say you're not brave enough, but you're brave enough to do this. You're being very open with me.
But for me, again, it's thinking if me saying one thing just helped one person, then that's important. And that was very much his mindset as well. And I do think within me, I'd love to be able to help other people in my situation. I think I can remember the times that I'd sit on my bed in the evening and just think, who can help? And I think there's a voice, if I could be that voice for someone and, you know, just to speak to, or there was something, someone I could have rung, I'd love to be able to be that person for somebody else.
And I bet you will.
Maybe we'll see.
Sandra, thank you ever so much for sharing all that with me.
Oh, thank you, Dylan. It's nice to talk to you.
We'll be having more chats in future episodes about everything to do with death and dying, such as how to prepare for it, what it's really like when someone dies, how to talk about it, what kind of plans to make, how different cultures and faiths approach dying and bereavement, lots more around grief and loss, how to support others in their sadness, and my personal hobby horse, how to rebuild a life, a good life, after the loss of someone special. If you'd like to join us to talk about the death of someone near to you, if this episode has resonated with you and you have a story to share, or if you've been affected by some of the issues raised, please do get in touch at hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.